Welcome to Life, Passion and Business. My name is Paul Harvey, and I'm looking for answers. What does it mean to be successful? What does it mean to have a good, well-lived life? This podcast is conversations with people that look like they have it sorted. Today's conversation is with Rosie O'Hara.
My passion is about confidence, and whether that confidence is to start a business, grow a business, improve a business, or one of my wishes is, it's for people to be able to communicate with everybody else effectively.
I had a wonderful conversation on my sofa with Rosie O'Hara. I've known Rosie for 10 years or more, mainly with her NLP practice. However, there is much more to Rosie. With 35 years of business experience, there's a lot to talk about. Originally working in mechanical engineering, she has a degree in German translation and interpreting. She's also one of the world's few leading master consultants, as well as a trainer and coach for the Words That Change Minds. She was a baker's wife, she's a published author with 4 books, and she can ride a motorcycle. And on top of all that, she likes to relax by crocheting unique hats. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Rosie O'Hara. So this is Life, Passion and Business. What I'm looking for is kind of that process. What is it? What has your life been about? And where's the passion, and how does that fit in with your business? So that's the kind of journey we're going to go on.
How long have we got?
Well, we're not. Yeah, the idea is to try and do it in about 30 minutes or so.
Right, okay. That's probably not long enough for what my life has been about. I suppose the thing for me about business is I probably started later than a lot of other people, but then I think what's important to remember is that I'm also older than a lot of people I work with and a lot of people who may be potentially in the world of business that I network with. So I'll be 65 this year. I was born at a time when, if you think about the 50s, and we see more things on TV and in films and books nowadays, women were supposed to stay at home. And they're supposed to cook, and you're supposed to be there. And there's that archetypal song, I think, Hey Little Girl or something, where you're supposed to make yourself up for hubby coming home from work. And even though some of that wasn't happening where I grew up in a suburb of Nottingham, there still was that overarching thing, the pressure, if you like, from women's magazines or TV or everything else was about being a good little girl, looking pretty, even wearing restricting corsets and things still in the 1950s, 60s, even into the 70s, because you had to look beautiful for everybody. You had to look
right. That. I remember growing with a child with the advert for the 18-hour girdle.
Yeah.
On
yes.
TV.
Yes. Yeah.
18 hours.
You know, that's a massive part of the day. I'd be wearing it still when I went to bed, I think, or something. Yeah, so that was the expectation. And the expectation, I think, women of my age who if they started a business early on, that they're very rare. So it took a long time. It also, my passion is about confidence, and whether that confidence is to start a business, grow a business, improve a business, or one of my wishes is, and for me it's combined, is for people to be able to communicate with everybody else effectively. Mm-hmm. And in that, to put their point across without anybody denigrating them for whatever reason. So whether they're a woman or whether they're a man, that's a bad idea. I don't think that'll work. For them to be able to put their point across and grow themselves in confidence, and also grow themselves in business. Which is where I've come to. So my life started out in a suburb of Nottingham, in a very multicultural, I realise now, suburb of Nottingham. So I have friends who were from Poland, from the Ukraine, from the Caribbean.
In the 50s. That's actually quite unusual.
Yeah, well, Nottingham was known for the rag trade. So yes. There was the lace market. And I know certainly that my nearest neighbours, who were kind of my age, their parents were Polish. Mm-hmm. And he was a tailor and she was a seamstress. She worked from home. So they had come for that. Some of the others will have come to work in in that area in the ironworks, so Stanton and Staveley, all these other things. And of course the people from the Caribbean came to the mother country, and it was a big area.
They were invited, weren't they?
They were invited
to drive the buses, I think, remember.
Well, yeah, to drive the buses. Yeah, I mean, one of the things, drive the buses worked for the NHS. They were men. So to me, growing up with all these different people was normal. I didn't know any different, and my parents never told me any different. We just accepted everybody. And then I grew up and I went out in the world, and I discovered that not everybody's like that. And as a child, I was bullied for being fat. I only know that's bullying now because my mother always told me that I should feel sorry for people and I should be nice to them. I spent a lot of time trying to work this out, and I did try really hard. I also experienced other things, which again, it's a whole life story that doesn't particularly belong in this, but there isn't much in life that I haven't experienced. I went from my short story is that at 18 I left home because I'd had enough of my father who would hit me, and I just said, that's it, I'm 18, I can leave, because the year I was 18 was the first year that with 18 you got the key of the door, so to say. And I went to Germany and I lived and worked in Germany. And
did you speak German?
I did. I started learning German when I went into grammar school, because I hated being the same as other people. I always wanted to be different, so we had a choice.
So it's the 50s, an unusual language to learn German, because...
But, now this is also where passion comes from. My German teacher was a lovely man called Mr. W. Leslie Morgan, and he was Welsh, and he had lived and worked in Germany as a teacher before the Second World War, and had only left because in order to continue working, he would have had to have become a paying member or a signed up member of the Nazi Party. And he came back to the UK, and he also maintained he was the only Welshman who couldn't sing. It's important because he did an all-round German learning experience. So we had this room, which we always went to for German. We always sat in the same seats. It was very much, two desks behind one another. I sat in the front desk for some reason, and my friend Barbara used to pull my pigtails. She says this isn't true. But we also had a room that I now know was full of things that were accelerated learning, actually, that were on the wall and that were permanently on the wall. This man instilled in me a passion to learn German and a passion to understand other people. So we had the whole, we had singing, we had reading, we had a scrapbook that we made. He taught us about Germany, had brought people in who taught us about Germany. We also had at least one student who bought a lot of books that I now know were Nazi story books that were all in that style, but we weren't
made aware
of that.
I'm really surprised to hear this, because at the time in the 50s there was still quite a lot of anti-German feeling.
Well, you're talking about now, I mean, this is 1964. When I went to grammar school, when I started grammar school. Yeah, in 64, I was at this particular school from 64 to 69. I wasn't aware. I suppose I was. I always felt sorry for the black and white TV films that you see, and the poor little German soldier who I knew was doing his job, and the nasty high-ups who got it in for him. I always felt sorry for them, and I always felt there was more to it. That's why I've always been interested in what motivates people and what stops them. And I think maybe that's where that comes from. I harbour this secret desire to understand them better and to understand people better. It's not, I don't know if that's particularly why I went to Germany.
So you ended up in Germany.
I did.
So what happened?
Well, in life we often have repeating patterns. So when I didn't marry the first man I met, but when I did marry, he was a guy who, not long after we first married, and then also about 3 years later, not longer than that, he put me in hospital. So he put me in hospital twice. I still stayed with him because, again, in the 1950s, 60s, you were brought up that marriage lasts for life. And you got married and you made the best of it. And I think it's all a learning experience. And I went through all of that. And with him, we then moved back to the, or I moved back to the UK. He came, I'd been ill. Again, there's a long story around that. And our daughter had been born. And we moved back to the UK. We moved back to Nottingham, different side of Nottingham. And he was an interesting guy. He came from the former East Germany. He was a baker and confectioner. That was his training. there's a lot of other stuff around him that one day I may write a novel based on his backstory and various of the things that happened to him or he said happened. But again, it was a learning experience, and he wanted to run his own business. So we ultimately bought a bakery. We would have liked to have bought a pub, but I thought that was perhaps not good. I thought he'd drink profits. So we bought a bakery, had a bakery and kind of, well, bakery and delicatessen, a little bit of confectionery in terms of that's, I'm talking about fancy sugar work and various things. And he learned how to do these spectacular things that we have for Harvest Festival time, not something he taught himself how to do it. So he's very, very accomplished. But I left him after 10 years and two children and actually moved to the northeast of England. Spent a lot of time on my own then, working for other people and using my German. And in the meantime, studied part-time and I have a degree in German and have a master's in translation and interpreting mechanical engineering, which is not often known as a fact, but it is a fact, and that's what I specialised in. I set up my own business in 1989. I lost the job that I had because my then boss saw me as a threat because I got on well with everybody. I worked latterly in credit control. My debtors' days were down to very low in the construction industry, because I would talk to people and because I would chase and find out what had gone wrong where. And my boss didn't like that, the finance director, and he actually organised it so that I left the company. And I worked in a few places. And then somebody asked me, I think I'd registered with somebody for doing some translation work and for doing a little bit of teaching. And I started doing that. And I then set up my first own company, which was about translation interpreting, which blossomed from German into English to something like 46 languages. And I also developed a teaching package for people who could speak German. And one of my requirements was they had lived in Germany for some part of their life, for whatever reason that was. So it might have been as a child, might have been they'd been out there as an au pair. I had a fantastic guy who'd been a bricklayer who we then actually got to go on and study German properly. He had a really good sense of humour. He'd often turn up in a baseball cap and the kids loved it. And I taught them to teach German, and we taught German in after school clubs.
Right.
And again, it's all about this understanding yourself better, understanding other people better was a constant theme. And having spent a long time keeping well away from men, I met my second husband, who unfortunately died.
Oh.
We weren't together very long, and we discovered that he had an inoperable brain tumour. And a bit of a nightmare, the whole thing was then, for lots of reasons. But as a result of that, I started becoming interested in how does the brain work? And at that time, if I get my brain to work harder and better, can I cure myself of that particular brain tumour? Not actually possible because of where that one was, and it's still today. That was 1997. It's still now maybe 20 years on, more than that, I can't remember. No, 1994 when Michael died. It would still be inoperable because of many, for so many
reasons.
But the
brain is perceived very differently from now how it was then. At that time, it was
extremely.
It was a static item, yeah. But nowadays we've been turned into more of a plastic item.
Yes, yes.
So in terms of reprogramming a brain, which obviously comes into your next conversation, yeah. It is very possible.
It is very possible, and I think that was the start of a journey that I'm still on and that I'm still interested in, because as you so rightly said, we became clear about the fact that the brain is a malleable object, is an object that grows, that there's more to the brain actually maybe than just that thing that's inside the skull. And I was interested in this teaching German, and I knew that anybody could learn German, or anybody, yeah, I still believe anybody can learn anything. You may not be perfect at it, but you can still do it. So you look at things, Eddie the Eagle springs to mind, literally, you know, a guy who, you can't possibly do this ski jumping, but he did it. You look at what they call the superhumans for the Paralympics. I struggled with that the first time when there was Paralympics. And I couldn't understand until one day my daughter I couldn't understand why they were superhumans. And my daughter made a comment, I grew up with a father who I never knew any other way than that he had an artificial leg below the knee. And my father never let that get in the way, all the things that he did. And so I didn't understand why somebody should be regarded as a superhuman. But I do, and also I grew up with a lot of people around me who had bits missing. So we'd frequently get visited by various people because they know my dad or they knew my mum who was an orthopaedic nurse. So our house was, to me, that was normal. So why that should be superhuman, I couldn't understand. I do now, and I also know a lot about artificial limbs. I know a lot about all kinds of things. I know a lot about shopping trolleys as well. But about the technical side.
Is there a connection between shopping trolleys and artificial limbs?
No, it's just the technical side. That's to do with the German. Anyway, I became originally interested in NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, in order to find out how you can get people to improve their learning.
Can you say a bit more about, you've kind of gone NLP, so you've said it very, very fast, and you know, I think I know what it is, but can you say a little bit more about what its foundations and what it actually is?
Its foundations started in the 1970s in California, and I was for many years led to believe it wasn't about sex, drugs and rock and roll, until I met a guy called Frank Puslik, who said it was about sex, drugs and rock and roll, which is a big problem with the origins of NLP, because a lot of them were having affairs with one another and a lot of marriages broke up, and there are a lot of stories around NLP. There is a really interesting book, the name of which I forget, which is, I think it's called The Origins of NLP, that came out a few years ago, which actually set out to set the record straight about who actually, where and how NLP actually originated. So the originators are really a guy called John Grinder, Frank Puslik was there, Richard Bandler, who you often hear, who gets NLP a bad name.
That was a name that was in my head, actually.
Yeah. He's one of the later people. He's very much a showy salesman. And he does get NLP a bad name, which is why I sometimes tend to go, because I continuously meet people who have gone through short, fast courses. So that might be a week intensive. And they've literally been put in a trance all week. And I've done a course with Bandler. I know what that's like for myself. But I managed to, if you like, stay meta and look from the outside in and saw what was going on. And if you come out of that, you believe you can change the world and you can change everybody, you can heal
so
everything.
Just for the sake of the listeners of this, of this podcast, what is NLP? What does it do for
Neuro-linguistic programming, right? So the neuro is your neurology, but we start with the language that you grow up with from a child. So there's always that there's a wonderful piece of poetry somewhere. If a child lives with abuse, then learns it, and it says, you know, if the child lives with criticism, it learns to criticize, all those things. So whatever we grow up with programs our lives. Now, some of us manage to break away from negative programming, but others of us, and I think some of that leads back to a conversation we had before this broadcast, others may become radicalized, is the far extreme end, because of the fact that somebody has got hold of them at an early age. But our programming changes from home to maybe preschool, kindergarten, whatever it is that you call it, to primary school, to secondary school, academy, grammar school, wherever that is in the world, then to college and university, and then the world of work. And each of these have their own form of language, their own form of programming. And we fail to realise that as human beings, we allow ourselves to be programmed by the kind of speak that we and others are using around us. So I live in an area that has Doric behind it. Murray has its roots in Doric, which is a form of Scots. And the Doric language itself is actually very negative. So when the New Testament was translated into Doric in 2012, I think it was, there were no words for peace or joy in Doric. And if you listen to people in the north of Scotland, so with that I categorise Dundee all the way up Aberdeen, round and across, probably until it hits Highland, there's a lot of negativity in the language and people grow up with negativity. And when we come in, class you and me as that, as incomers, outsiders, the language can be very negative and very hard for us to get on with. And I've worked with people locally who've come into, so they may have come in from another area of Scotland or from England to work with people up here, and they struggle with the negativity. But it's understanding, so this programming, although it sounds completely negative, isn't. That's actually what drives people forwards by knowing what they don't want. It can be hard words sometimes. But that's the programming. So the programming is the language, and this affects our neurology, and our neurology affects the way we think. It can affect the way we sit, walk, talk, stand, all those things. If we spend too much time with certain people or too much time believing something, we'll start saying things like, it's a pain in the neck, I'm being stabbed in the back. There are two things. I've had much worse things from people I've worked with. And when I get them to look at those and maybe write them down, and in some cases I've got them to write them in big letters on a flip chart, and to look at that, they then start to realise they are programming themselves to embody that. So they have a stiff neck, they have a bad back, they have other things going on with them, because it's all these metaphors that we're applying to ourselves all the time. And we live in a world of metaphors so much of the time.
So this is what you're saying, is that the language people use and the words they think about effectively program how they behave and how
yes.
they act and how their body acts.
Yeah. So there is.
It's interesting you say this, because I did quite a lot of acting training
uh-huh.
a while ago. And one of the aspects of that, I mean, certainly in the Stanislavski approach, is the same thing, but in reverse. So what Stanislavski will do is teach people to imagine a time in their life and connect that to the text or the words they're using, so they can generate the emotion and
mm-hmm.
the feelings and the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another one, there's Augustus Boal, he's a Russian guy who did some very similar stuff. He would do actions or things to kind of bring out a feeling or bring out a, you know, talk, well, how do I capture my misery and my pain, and
mm-hmm.
how do I put my body into that position to feel that?
And that's a really good example of how the mind and body then affects one another.
Yeah.
And the secret is, if you're doing that as acting, you need to be able to let go of it. And there are a lot of famous actors people can probably think of who've then potentially killed themselves or died of an overdose or something, because they actually don't get rid of all these different personas that they have, that they've acted in. They don't get rid of them successfully. The successful actors who manage to survive are the ones who can literally brush it off. And there are ways of doing that.
Well, there's a famous story, isn't there? I think it was the marathon runner. And you had two differently trained actors. You had, and both their names have gone out of my head, but you know, you had this, you know, this is going to be a trouble now because I'm not going to get their names. But you know, you had a Stanislavski trained actor who was like not sleeping for days, who was doing all this sort of stuff to try and get into the path of this person.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the classic trained actor said, my boy, just try acting.
Yeah,
good.
Yeah. and it does, you know, and we need to be aware that happens, and we need to learn ways of
Dustin Hoffman
off.
And Laurence Olivier.
Oh,
I knew it would come eventually.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, I can see that in each of them. It's interesting, and they're also, I mean, they're from different decades as well.
They are,
well,
yeah.
All these things are really interesting. The culture we grew up in, the decade that we grow up in, they all have bearings on who we are and how we act. NLP has always looked at what works, and it's borrowed things from other people that work, and it's put them together. And it's very interesting, and it has so many applications. But I became more interested in one part of it, which are the meta programs. Meta's always out of conscious awareness, from the Greek, but in NLP it's out of conscious awareness. And I mentioned the Doric being, to some people, a very negative language.
Yeah.
And it's not, NLP will tell you that's away from language. It's about knowing what you don't want. So a lot of UK NLP, USA, state American NLP, is get rid of that. But you can't get rid of that if that's inherent in your culture.
No.
You know, you've been brought up with that. There's a book called The Scots Crisis of Confidence by a woman called Carol Craig. And Carol Craig states she doesn't like positive psychology. And I met her once briefly, and I have since corresponded with her to explain, I don't believe in positive psychology. I believe that looking at where the person is and working with that. I don't say to someone, well, you think you can't do that. Well, what would happen if you did? You have to get them there slowly and have to find out, why do they think that way? What's the motivation behind that? What's the permission? By use of language, a lot of fast NLP fails to concentrate on the language and how the person's saying what they're saying, and then exploring that, and then meeting them where they are. So I'm one of the world's few master consultants in something called the Language and Behavior Profile, which is based on the meta programs in NLP, and it's based on language, and it's based on identifying how someone says what they say, and then working with them. And the technical term we use is meeting them at their bus stop. So if you start telling me about all the problems you have, I don't want to get you in a problem state, but I want to know about these problems. I want to work with you. So a lot of my clients are from Aberdeen, for example. They are dyed-in-the-wool Aberdonians. And these are a lot of my successful clients who I work with successfully. And yet I'm English, and I like this positive side. And we work together well because I look at what their language is saying about them, how are they reacting and acting. I started work with a new client last week, and he was interesting because he said to me, he's relatively young as well, I was trained in a certain way, and I was trained properly, and I went to university and I learned all this, etc. And I was trained by people to react when they told me what to do. And I now notice, now that I run my own business, I cannot use those methods with young people nowadays. So the classic way that he was trained by his teachers, mm-hmm. whoever they were, and also he was trained in a different culture as well, does not work. And he said, so I potentially lose people who are good, and then that cost me. And this is a wonderful insight from him anyway, because some people don't understand that. They'll blame the other people. But he said, what I realize is I'm losing people who are good at what they do. And if I changed how I approach them and my approach to them, I could retain them, because it costs me more money to let them go and hire someone else than it does because I need to retrain that person, and then I've invested so much time and money in. And it was a great insight from him, because I've met other people in the past. I can think of someone who I'm related to by birth, and he always believed it was everybody else's fault. If you didn't do it his way, my way or the highway, or you go, people are expendable, I can hire somebody else. And yet this guy has looked at the bottom line and said, this is not going to work if I do this. So I'm working with him to help him understand how he is programmed, what language he uses, and how that affects the neurology of other people, if you like, and also how he can then temporarily change how he says what he says in order to get them to understand that actually he really likes them and he would like them to stay. Because they're coming there, if you like, at a different bus stop or not on the same page as him.
That's quite a fundamental change, to get someone to change how. You know, if it's something ingrained in someone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To actually get them someone to kind of put an edit on what they're going to say and go, no, I need to run that through my filter to get them to get it to say it the right way. It's almost like changing how they, you know, I guess you slow everything down a little bit so that they're not speaking from the...
Yeah.
From the hip, so to speak.
Yes, and it's that important thing. It's as well, I meet people, because as you know, we originally met many years ago through networking. I meet people at networking events all the time, and some of them I put my hands over my head in terms of, oh no, you have this passion for your business, but unfortunately your passion is going to... It's a bit like, I don't know if you remember Danny Kaye and Tubby the Tuba. And Tubby the Tuba wanted the tune, and he so desperately wanted to play the tune in the orchestra that he got hold of it and he squashed it. and he flattened it, and the tune was no longer any good. And I have that metaphor in my head sometimes. I mean, not everybody's as old as me, so they may not remember Danny
DeKay. I don't know that. So you've gone over my head, I'm afraid.
Well, Danny DeKay did a lot of stories, because Danny Kaye did a lot of stories on things like LPs and EPs when I was a child, and on the radio a lot, and they often involve music, and this one is particular. I think it's about the orchestra, and when the tune comes to the tuba, that of course just duh, duh, or whatever that is all the time, the tuba is desperate to get a tune to play, and eventually it grabs hold of the tune, but it grabs hold of it so hard that it squashes it flat and there's no tune at all. And I meet people who are a bit like excited puppies, and they tell you about all this, and I'm thinking, yeah, and then the next bit is, but I'm not quite sure how to get or retain customers, and it's partly because they're bounding up and literally licking them all over the face.
Yes.
And it's
Tigger.
Tigger's a really good example. They need to sit down. Don't need to be quite like Eeyore, because Eeyore, well, it might rain later, so I'm not going to go out now, you know. You need to be kind of more like Winnie the Pooh, who's, well, you know, if I do get that balloon and float up in the honey tree, maybe I'll get the bee from the bee, the honey from the bees. To think about opportunities and to look at it from a different angle. And that big change that you're talking about, this like speaking from the hip there, he only needs to make that change in order to achieve what he wants to achieve as a business. He doesn't need to change himself, because this words that change minds, language and behaviour profile, is contextual. So in context with our nearest and dearest, we will probably react differently than we will in context with our employees or with customers or clients or whatever that is. And if you've only ever learned to do it that way, then you're only ever going to teach people the same way that worked for you. I mean, this happens in schools. This happens why children are often classed as being unteachable or anything else, because the teacher has only learned one way of teaching, and that's actually the way they learned. So that's all they can pass on. The best teachers I've ever worked with are ones who've come to me and said, well, I've learned how to teach, but I don't know how people learn. Help me learn how people learn and how I can help them learn. Because there is a big mismatch, and there's a big mismatch between what I would call the typical world of teachers probably in 40 plus bracket and the pupils who they're getting in, who are growing up in this digital world. And this digital world applies to anybody born after 1980. There are so many things that I've looked at, I've studied, and I've worked with. And one of the last courses I trained in Aberdeen last year, half the course were born after 1980, and the other half were actually, most of them were older than I was, which was really interesting to see that they wanted to learn how to communicate more effectively. And it's a lovely realisation when you have two sides of a room who say, now I understand why I'm having difficulty getting my point across to you. Because they're literally being programmed to speak in different ways.
I want to carry on this, but what I've noticed we have done is we've dived into your passion. We were going on learning sequentially onto your life. I asked you about NLP, and you've gone straight into that conversation. And I'm just wondering, because you've travelled a long way since you started NLP.
Yeah.
And then you got into the meta side of it. So what happened? How did you move from being a baker's wife?
Well, I left him.
You left him.
That's the first move.
Okay, you did leave him.
Then I spent a long time on my own, and I had this language company, and I trained other people to teach German and set up all these things. And in 1994, Michael died, and by 1998, both my children had left home. Mm-hmm. My son went to live and work in Germany because that's what he wanted to do. That is where he lives nowadays, and he's married. I taught him German. My daughter was brought up bilingually. My daughter was living in London because theoretically that was the centre of the universe. It's not the same now because she now lives in the same small town that I do. Mm-hmm. And I moved to Glasgow. I could have gone anywhere else in the world, but I was fascinated by the architecture of Charles Rennie Mackintosh, which is why I went there. I still was translating And then for various reasons, again, it's a long story, I moved from Glasgow right up to almost the far north of Scotland to a place called Latheren, which is 17 miles south of Wick, where I had a wee white cottage and a burn, which is a stream, if you don't mm-hmm. know what a burn is, in the garden. And I kept hens, and I had a third of an acre. And my neighbours were, I have to get this right, sheep and ageing alcoholics. So in the afternoon, when they asked you if you'd take a wee refreshment, it certainly wasn't the cup of tea. It would be what's known in Scotland as a household dram. And as at the time...
Which is not a wee dram.
Absolutely not. And at the time, I didn't drink whiskey. I stayed up there for a couple of years. It was lovely, but it's too far away from the rest of Scotland. Mm. At that time, travel time to Inverness would be a minimum of 3.5 hours. And having done the trip again recently, I defy anybody to say really it's any less at the moment. I mean, literally, I've taken time with you.
But it is a beautiful part of the world, isn't
it? It's lovely.
But as you say, a bit far out to do anything. So it comes back into the smoke as such.
I came to Nairn originally, and then but then I moved to Forres, quite a lot of things happened then. I moved down to Nairn to set up.
So did you have the translation company at the time?
I still had that, but the object of moving down there was to actually set up the original NLP training company, because it was too far to travel, and to set up something for Scotland that appreciated that you didn't need this positive psychology, that you could meet people where they are. And I started with that.
Is it NLP Highland?
It was NLP Highland.
I remember hearing it when I first arrived here, NLP Highlands.
Yes. That was what I was in a previous incarnation.
Yeah.
But that's an incarnation that I've left behind for quite a while now. And I then moved to Forres in 2004, and I had my son living with me for a while. He then disappeared back to Germany, which was a big blow for me. It was probably the one that I'd cope with the stuff with my first husband. I cope with the stuff with my father, with my first husband, my second husband dying, and my son leaving. I really didn't cope with that well, and that was just me not employing any NLP principles or anything else. I just didn't. It seemed like the last straw at the time. Now life. There is a lovely saying from the best exotic Marigold Hotel: it will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, it's not the end.
Yes.
My life's definitely not an end. Various other things went on, I suppose. In 2000 and the end of 2006, one of my former trainees and someone who worked together with me for a while, and along with various other people, they were all deciding I should find a man. So she...
They matchmade for you.
Yeah, well, she did. And she set me up to meet my beloved Jim. And I met him, and we've been together ever since. We got married in 2011. But Jim... Not but Jim. And Jim had been widowed twice before. Both of his wives died as a result of cancer. It was... a bit of a blow to him when in 2009 I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And knowing then what I know now, I probably would never have had a mastectomy, but at the time I opted for a mastectomy. In some ways it was the easy way out, trust me on that. A mastectomy and nothing else, and I haven't looked back from that since then.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any further medication treatment or a reconstruction or anything else. That was my deal with the surgeon, that I wasn't going to have any of that. And we got through that, and I got Jim on my side literally by using the words that changed minds, by realizing that he wasn't going to cope unless I actually met him at his bus stop. Mm-hmm. And a few days after I'd spoken to him, in fact, my stepdaughter, who lives locally, phoned me and said, "What did you do to my dad? I didn't expect him to be reacting the way he was in view of everything else that had gone on in his life previously." And I just explained to him the way it works for him. So although I've never he's never done any training with me, I can get him on my side most of the time, because being married to somebody is different to working with somebody on a professional basis.
You can't bring the tools home, can you?
No. And I always say that to people when the training course. My first caveat is, please do not go home and use this on your family. I am not responsible for any breakdowns in marriages or divorces. Although I have worked with people who have got divorced. I've also worked with people who've got married. They tell me it's a result of the work I've done with them. In fact, last year we were invited to two weddings with former clients of mine, which is really lovely, but I'm not sure that I take all the credit for that. And in 2012 I was diagnosed as having lupus, which means that my immune system doesn't work properly. I kind of ignored that for a while, but last year my GP sat me down and finally convinced me that you really do have this,
so he
and
came
you
to
need
your
to
bus
be careful. He definitely came to my yes, he actually did. He definitely came to my bus stop. And so I need to be careful, but that doesn't always work. So I've developed another passion, which you asked me about earlier, which is actually crochet. And I crochet hats, and then I always need to show people a picture of a hat, because they look at me and say, oh well, what kind, and then I show them things like dragons and that actually sit on the hat.
Yes, I have seen your hats. they are certainly hats to behold.
Thank you. So they become a passion. They become a passion in the creation. And the last couple of days, I went for a couple of easier ones. So one was a cat and one was something else. But now I'm going to do a donkey. So these things help me relax. And I love it when somebody buys one and I see the smile on their face. And they tell me what they're going to do with it and all kinds of things.
So what's the secret then? What's the secret to keeping passion in life and business then?
The secret, I think, of keeping passion in your life is finding something that you enjoy that doesn't encroach on other people, so by that I mean, so if you think about the words that change minds, I don't go around telling everyone I have the solution. I may well have the solution, but I don't go around doing that.
You might think it.
The thing is, Paul, 99.99999% of the time I am proved right. I get people. I had somebody who came back to me last year who caused me a horrendous amount of trouble in 2000, and I can't remember whether it was 8, 9 or something. And I could have almost torn my hair out several times over this particular person. And out of the blue, I got a contact message from them on a professional business site. I need to apologise to you, was what they said. Oh, do you? Because of such and such. I said, you know, that's lovely, but I'm really glad you've got yourself sorted out.
Yeah, but the reality is, you know, no matter who it is, you know, people will never get there until they're ready to go.
Oh, no, I mean...
And you can lead that horse to water. I mean, they ain't going to bloody drink a thing unless they are really ready to hear it.
Which is why I don't jump all over people, or I may make the suggestion, can we have a chat? In fact, some cups of coffee that I have had with various people, and I can look at some people and name them... In the north of Scotland, in particular, so whether we're looking at Aberdeen to Highland, and I think, do you know, they've actually made a fortune from buying me that cup of coffee, because I'll just ask questions, and those questions are meant to be thought provoking, and one in particular, yeah, I'm in Inverness. It's like, no, I've stopped having cups of coffee with people. In that I make it quite clear, you want me to ask you questions, do whatever, no, we'll have a proper paper session. Because I think if I have the royalties and some of that. And having said that, I like to see other people succeed. I like to see people succeed with their passion.
We're going to come to an end to this, because you said it could be a long conversation, and I could talk to you for a long time. I could sense that we could go on and on. And we've been talking 40 minutes. So I think it's probably enough of our conversation. So let's try to tie it together. Clearly, you live a life of passion, and you are still very passionate in the work that you do, which is fantastic to hear you speaking. I can see it. I mean, obviously, I have the advantage of seeing you today.
Yes.
But I can really hear it in here, yeah, talking to me. What I ask everyone to do at the end of one of these interviews, is there anything that you would set people, like something that they could go and do, like a little exercise or something that they could go and do that you think could make a difference in their life? That something that you've discovered. Now, obviously, you've got the advantage of NLP, but, I mean, other people have said, it was this in my life that made a difference. Try this.
I think, and it's interesting, you were saying about NLP, but if I go back to Mr. W. Leslie Morgan, my first German teacher, he had this all-round view of the German lesson even then in 1964, which is very unusual. So you had a textbook, you had a reading book, you had singing, you had all these different things. Life is not flat, it's not monochrome, it's not black and white, whatever it is. Maybe scribble that and say, no, there is a poem, I forget who it's by, it's upon Westminster Bridge, oddly, but what is this life but full of care? We have no time to stop and stare. We need to, or I suggest, that you stop and you stare. And in that stopping and staring, and this is something that I've done for years, just think about what you really want to do. And think about, how will that affect me? What will I actually be seeing around me? What will I say to myself? Will other people say anything? And how will that feel? We often don't kind of get dressed in that and feel it when I've got that. And when am I going to achieve that by? Set a time frame on it. Because if we don't set a time frame, we will never do it. We just won't go there. We'll do that kind of manana thing. Oh yeah, I'll do it in good time. I think that's it. So stop and stare, and in that stopping and staring, see what it is you want to do, hear it, feel it, and set a time frame on it. And do remember other people, because if you want to go around the world in 80 days or whatever that is, if you're with a partner, children, or you're at work, how is it going to affect them? For some people, I know it won't matter, but for most people, it does.
I really want to thank you, Rosie. It has been a great conversation with you. I really enjoyed it, and I could go on forever, but I'm going to stop it there. So thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Paul. You're welcome.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Rosie O'Hara. What a great conversation. I could have spoken to Rosie all afternoon. So are you going to take her lead and follow your passion? If you've enjoyed this conversation, please like this podcast and subscribe and follow, because this is just one of the many fantastic conversations that there are to come. It only remains me to say thank you for listening, and I'll catch you again soon.